theater, like many other places in society, used to be segregated. Once white men played all the parts on stage, male and female. You can dismiss that as, well, that was back in Shakespeare's day, but then consider that within some of our lifetimes, black musicians and actors would perform in front of exclusively white audiences. Black people could be on stage, but not in the seats. Or in some cases, they could be in the theater seats, but those were up in the balcony. Southern Oregon University's campus theme of race brings a number of challenging discussions to campus, including a panel discussion on race and theater set for Monday at 3:30 at the Mies Auditorium on SOU's campus. Eric Levin is the Associate Professor of Theater and panel member who is here in the studio with us today. Eric, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
As democratic as theater can be, then, obviously there's a long history of segregation both by race and by gender, isn't there?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Give us some examples of the history, I mean, other than what we just talked about here.
Well, the first African-American to take a lead role on stage was in 1920 with Eugene O'Neill's The Emperor Jones. It was also the first expressionistic theater from an American playwright. And one of the interesting things is it was an immediate hit. It was Eugene O'Neill's leftist leanings that brought him to the stage. His producer didn't particularly want to do it that way. They wanted to go with the old burnt cork on the face. But O'Neill was adamant, and they hired an elevator operator who had briefly worked on Broadway named Charles Gilpin. And Gilpin that year won the Dramalogue Award for the best actor in a Broadway show. But after they invited him to the dinner, several people said they wouldn't eat with a man of color. O'Neill himself refused to go to the dinner unless they invite. He had won for the play, and he refused to go to the dinner unless Charles Gilpin was reinvited, and he was, which was great. And in his later years, O'Neill said that Gilpin was the greatest actor he ever worked with. Unfortunately, Gilpin grew into the part and played it for a couple of years, began to drink more, and decided that this was his play, and he began changing the words. He refused to say the N-word on stage anymore. He refused to call himself that. And he and O'Neill had words, and O'Neill fired him and hired a young actor named Paul Robeson, who went on to fame in his plays. So it's even within the liberal elite of America, there is a tremendous amount of racism and a lack of understanding between the races.
I was hoping we would get to Paul Robeson at some point, because it seems like he's a good example of a person whose politics were not necessarily far out of line with other people in the theater business, but because he was black, it seemed like he got more vilified for his political views.
I think that's true. And he was a world-class opera singer. He had won numerous awards for his stage shows. He was the original singer of Old Man River and Showboat. And he was an avowed communist. Not to mention all-American football player.
Interesting combination.
And he was a communist. He was stopped from going to the USSR. Was it the U.S.? I think it was Russia.
It was still the
USSR.
Time. Okay. Well, it depends on when.
You're right. Yeah. It was in the 1920s. And he was refused a visa to get out of the country. He was basically trapped in America and became an activist, or he already was, but was very, very vocal. And he was vocal up into the 1950s, I believe.
We're talking about race and theater with Eric Levin, an associate professor of theater at Southern Oregon University. Sort of a warm-up for the panel discussion on race and theater coming up on Monday at 3:30 at the Mies Auditorium on the SOU campus at the Arts Center. You can join us here and now on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about race and theater and race as it relates to performance in America. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email jx@jeffnet.org. There are obviously plenty of works directly on the African-American experience, and August Wilson's works stand out here. It seems like these are works that would have been impossible to stage a few decades ago, at least to a general audience. Let's put it that way.
Because of the lack of
Because of segregation, yeah.
That may be true, but they weren't written then. You know, I don't think August Wilson would have been a poet as he began. I think people move into the areas where they feel welcome and where they find success. I think the same can be said of Lorraine Hansberry 10 years before writing A Raisin in the Sun. I don't think it could have been produced. And that's a specifically African-American play. But I think August Wilson did something different. And it's interesting to talk about O'Neill and August Wilson in the same conversation, because August Wilson did in his lifetime what O'Neill wanted to do and never could do, and that is encapsulate the history of the United States in a series of plays. And August Wilson was able to do that.
Decade by decade in the Hill District of Pittsburgh, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure. One of the things that struck me as a young graduate student was that I never thought of August Wilson as an African-American playwright. His plays engaged people on so many levels, or still do, engage people on so many levels that everybody can identify with them. You don't have to say, oh, that's what it's like to be African-American. You can say, oh, that's what it's like to be me. And I think he's the first to really capture that.
Let's talk about one of the topics that will that's apparently a logical progression for the race and theater discussion you'll have on Monday, which is colorblind casting, the idea that you just simply put the good actors in the good roles and it doesn't matter what color they are, whereas years ago it would have been, oh, no, this has to be a white person played by a white person.
Right.
How long has colorblind casting been in vogue, or when did it first arise? Because when we're talking about O'Neill, for example, casting Mr. Gilpin, as Charles Gilpin, as the Emperor Jones, this is something that called for a black actor in a black role, and probably a few years before they would have used a white actor.
I think the first the first person that I ever heard of a black actor playing a nondescript role was Louis Gossett Jr. in Officer and a Gentleman. Mm-hmm. I think 80s or 90s. Mm-hmm. When I was in junior high school, we used to go to ACT Theater in San Francisco, and they frequently had multiracial casts. However, I think it was done on purpose to say something about race. The first theater that I heard of that did multiracial or colorblind casting is OSF. And interesting enough, there was a huge discussion about colorblind casting in the theater world about 1996. Mm-hmm. I'm going to forget his name now. On one side was August Wilson, mm-hmm. and on the other side was Robert Brustein, who was head of the American Repertory Theater at the time. But it was August Wilson who came out vehemently against colorblind
casting. I noticed that. He really found it an aberration, was what he called it.
What he said was that an African-American cast in Death of a Salesman has no resonance. That's not the culture that African-Americans came from. The American Dream is a specifically white American creation. And according to the play, it was a creation to entrap middle-class people into doing what the powers that be want them to do. But it's interesting. He said that no, he would never accept a white cast in his plays. And, of course, the cultural roots of his plays are so African-American and so rooted in the history of the United States. Of course you wouldn't do that. That would be disrespectful. And yet he sees it the other way, too. He sees particularly African-American casts playing traditionally Caucasian plays or mainstream plays as being abhorrent, that this is not the culture that these people came from.
We're talking about race and theater with Eric Levin, Associate Professor of Theater at Southern Oregon University. There'll be a discussion just like this with Micah Cole and Claudia Alec from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival Monday at 3:30 at the Meese Auditorium at the Arts Center on the Southern Oregon University campus. Join this discussion now. Let's hear what you think about race and theater and how things have changed over the years and how perhaps your own conceptions have been challenged. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was just trying to think about examples of colorblind casting I could think of. Jesus Christ Superstar in New York in the early 70s, Ben Vereen as Judas. I remember there was a bit of a stir. It's like, wait a minute, Judas wasn't black, but they went ahead and did it anyway. I wonder, though, in context, if it's easier to put a black Judas into a play that's a rock play about Jesus as essentially a rock star.
Perhaps, But there's a bigger conversation there. First of all, Judas probably was black, as was Jesus in some way, shape, or form. But to cast an African-American as Judas seems to be suggesting that the evil character in this story can be of color, and the God of all of us is white. Mm-hmm. And so that conversation went on too, and seemed a little. Of course, it brought Ben Vereen to attention, and that's almost worth it.
Truly, yeah, because this all went on before Roots and his right. big role as Chicken George. Let's take some calls. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Levin. We're talking race and theater.
Yes, I once heard Patrick Stewart of Star Trek fame interviewed on the radio while he was playing Othello with an otherwise all-African-American cast done in Washington, D.C.
And what did he have to say about it?
Oh, he said it was quite interesting, especially the part where he said, I thank God I am black.
It wasn't done in blackface, I'm thinking. Or
oh, no. He was, like I say, he was the only Caucasian in this otherwise all African-American cast.
What's interesting about that is we talk about color blind casting. That is a very specific choice that the director made, and a very interesting one to reverse the racial roles of the play.
So instead of Othello being the only black person, he was the only white person.
And how does that resonate?
And did you? So you just heard the interview about it. You didn't see the play yourself, Mark?
No, I just heard the interview. I did not see the play. There's one time I did see a production of Henry V in Providence, Rhode Island, and they had one African-American member of the whole cast. I presumed he was around in case they ever wanted to do Othello, but I wasn't certain.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Well, I mean, we have advanced quite a bit then, it seems like, in decades, because stage shows decades past would have had, I mean, there was tokenism at some point, I'm assuming, where there would be a few black people on stage just to sort of round out the color, but probably not in the major roles.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true or not. The interesting thing, though, is that when colorblind casting first came about, it was almost a way of integrating theater, like schools were integrated. And what I find interesting is that over the years, we've truly been able to start to ignore and not try to find meaning in the race of the actors who are cast. And I think that was the goal. And I don't know if by any means any kind of achievement has been had. But at the same time, when I was a student going to theater, if you saw an African-American on stage, there was a particular reason for it. And colorblind casting has really done a lot to kind of move that forward, because most playwrights don't discuss what race their characters are.
Let us take another call. Here's Fry in McKinleyville. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Levin. We're talking race and theater.
Hi. It seemed to me that a very early example of colorblind casting was Audra McDonald in Carousel. And that might have predated An Officer and a Gentleman by a decade or so.
Okay. Audra McDonald in Carousel. Yeah. Okay. And when was that? Do you know?
You know, I can't just spout dates. I'm sorry, I'm not a theater professional or something.
I don't think she's that
probably
old.
Online somewhere.
All right, yeah, and plus Audra McDonald was also in a TV version of Annie, in which
right.
she played
right.
yeah, the lead female character. Thank you for that, Fry. I appreciate the boost there on our knowledge. So it's been happening then. It's interesting to think about it in this context, because when she was talking about Audra McDonald, my mind flashed to television generally. Audra McDonald was part of the cast of Private Practice on ABC for several years. Thinking about the fact, though, that there was a big stink, even in the civil rights era, when Captain Kirk kissed Lieutenant Uhura.
That's right.
Of course, they were possessed and couldn't control themselves at the time. But, you know, the context was always kind of wacky to think about people still making a big deal out of these things at a time when civil rights was advancing by leaps and bounds in the country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, a lot of racism as well as gender issues come from the sexualization of our perceptions of people. We attribute various elements to people, and that's how we think of people when we look at them. So things like integration and you know, force busing, things like that, do a lot to help people exchange ideas. By being in close proximity, you talk and you realize that race is something that is very, very surface. There could be cultural elements to it, but the race itself, the things we see, is very surface. What's great during this century is that we're starting to look at race a lot different. A lot of people are self-proclaiming their race rather than allowing the society to do it. And I think that's where the shift is that we have a little bit more freedom now to say, well, no, I'm not white. I'm Puerto Rican, white, and African-American, and I embrace all those, or I embrace two of those.
Or Tiger Woods calling himself a Caublasian.
There you go.
Caucasian, black, and Asian, all kinds of. Are there lingering tattoos in theater? I guess this has to be our final question. We're almost out of time. But are there lingering taboos, places where people don't go racially in theater companies?
I thought you said tattoos, and it would be easy answer.
Right. Taboos a little harder.
You know, I've never been in I'm a theater educator. I've never been in professional theater, and I think that's probably something that's going to come up in the panel. I'm the historical guy, and most of the people that we're talking with have personal experience of being of color within the theater world, or having work in the professional theater world.
All right, we will. Eric Levin will be with Micah Cole and Claudia Alec, and are any other people on the panel?
Louis Dauphetus.
Oh, Louis Dauphetus, yeah. the lead dramaturg at right. The Oregon Shakespeare Festival as well. That's Monday at 3:30 at the Mies Auditorium at the Arts Center on the Southern Oregon University campus. Eric Levin, associate professor of theater at SOU. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you too, very much.
That'll do it for this hour of the Exchange. We'll talk again about ADD in hour number two with Dr. Wes. Stay tuned.